Hello? Hello? Will? Will?
Yes, Will?
In November of 1983, a monster slays a research scientist at a Department of Energy facility in Hawkins, a small Indiana town. During the ensuing chaos, a test subject, a little girl named Eleven, also escapes. The monster is later connected to the disappearance of Will Byers, a Hawkins native. While local authorities search for Will, Eleven managed to elude a squad of federal agents.
Will's mother, Joyce, thinks she makes contact with her missing son over the phone, but the line shorts out, severing the brief garbled contact. Will's friends, Mike, Lucas, and Dustin, decide to form their own search party. While they don't find Will, they do run into Eleven, who's lost in the woods. Welcome to Dungeons & Demogorgons, the officially unofficial podcast for Stranger Things on Netflix. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we just watched Season 1, Episode 1, the premiere. I forget the name of it. Chapter 1, The Vanishing of Will Byers. It's a fitting name for this one, because Will goes missing. What'd you think of this episode?
Man, it's... Can we talk about our experience with Stranger Things?
Sure, yeah.
Because, like, it's been a year since I've seen this. I was I think a week or two into it release when I started watching it. And at the time, my wife and I were house shopping, and we watched the first four episodes. I do this thing where before I buy a house, I park on the street by the house during a Friday night to see Friday night's where all the crazy things happen. So we parked in this dark alley, and we watched it on my laptop, piped through my car's speaker system, and it gave this, we started 11 o'clock at night, running through, 3 a.m., and it gave it, a real drive-in through, and, I also, I'm, the perfect age for this to hit me. I was born in 76, so, in 1983, I'd have been 7 or 8. These kids are a little bit older, but recognizably dressing the way a kid. It's set in a small Indiana town. I am from a small Indiana town.
Oh my my! Oh hell yeah!
And this was, I guess, filmed in Georgia, but way they filmed and lit and shot some of this foggy stuff, it's recognizably stands in for rural Indiana. And it's about this kind of band of misfit boys. I was a misfit boy myself. So it really spoke to me, and in this kind of timeless Spielberg, Stephen King. And the other thing is it intentionally apes all those things.
Yeah.
With the Stranger Things font looks just like one of the Stephen King's 1980s titles. And to the extent that I actually thought the conceit was this was a Stephen King novel I just never heard of that someone had adapted into a Netflix series. And I remember after I finished it, I can't wait to read the novel. This is going to be cool. And then, no. But that's, I think, a testament that they're able to capture the things that made some of that, Stand By Me and It and E.T. special, but also something wholly unique, the Duffer Brothers doing that. So I thought the series as a whole was awesome, and this first episode, amazing job at pacing and moving through a big cast of characters. When it was over, I couldn't believe. I'm holy shit, that was it? I thought I'd been watching this for 25 minutes or so.
No, it's a 48-minute episode that, you're right, feels 25. I'm super impressed with, you said, the efficiency of it, but also the quality of it,
Yeah.
They're not just skipping through this. They're doing a really good job introducing us to all these characters.
And in retrospect, it's weird that, some scenes Nancy flirting with her new boyfriend don't drag, because they establish the stakes are life and death. This monster slaughters a full-grown man. It abducts or does something to this little boy. There's a little girl in danger, and a man gets killed in a diner for trying to protect her. And yet it keeps going back to these mundane, just kind of everyday things. And you've got a frantic mother juxtaposed against an apathetic law enforcement officer, and all this danger juxtaposed against these teen romances.
Yeah.
And you'd think it would try your patience. Jesus Christ, can we get back to the Demogorgon or whatever? But it doesn't. It doesn't.
No, it never does. And I think that's a testament to how good all of the characters are. The friends of Will are, in my opinion, the highlight. And it's probably because I identify so much with them, right? Like you said, I grew up in an Indiana town, and it's like, okay, this is me.
Right.
This is totally me. And they each have their own distinct personalities, and they play so well off of each other that that opening scene, the cold open that they do with not the monster killing the research scientist, but them playing Dungeons and Dragons, right, is so fantastic. And I immediately like Mike because I think Mike is a great DM here.
He could
sit back and say, okay, well, I guess I'll wait here until fucking what's his face Will makes his decision. And just let it be, but he keeps pressing and he keeps pushing, right? He ratchets up the tension and the anxiety until he forces Will into a decision. And I think that's like a really good move on a DM's part.
Yeah, I mean, there's it's funny because this is classic Hollywood. It's your memories only perfect and better because there's no fucking way an 11-year-old would have that kind of presence to be that kind of DM.
Uh-huh.
But it's, you know, it looks fun and it encapsulates all the memories you have of playing board games or role playing games with your friends. And it's got this heightened realism to it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, man, like, these are my friends, only, like, cooler.
And I love the little nods that it gives to, I guess, Will's impending disappearance, right? Like, when he says, oh, I rolled a 7, the Demogorgon got me.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I see what you did there.
Right.
Good stuff. And then the X-Men comic that he wants from Dustin.
Right.
I don't know. There's a lot of little touches like that, not just in the setting and the feel, but also in these characters.
And also does a lot of believably, kind of in the same way that Goonies does, where they set this thing where, like, the kids have this feeling that the adults aren't taking the situation as serious as they need, or they need to take it into their own hands, and it sets a stage where they can do, like, it's nothing, they don't, it's nothing splashy. They just put on raincoats and they go outside and look for their friend. And they sneak out of their house and have, like, this adventure. And that's, like, I think that really rings true. And that's another thing is, like, I forgot. I grew up in a small neighborhood in a rural town that had a lot of my family that lived in it. And, like, my cousins and I would communicate via giant walkie-talkies our parents bought from Radio Shack. Which, we didn't come up with that idea on our own. There was another movie... Maybe it was Flight of the Navigator. There's something that introduced that into our consciousness, and we begged and whined and pleaded until our parents got us walkie-talkies.
Yeah.
But, like, so fucking cool.
Cloak and Dagger? No.
That's what I'm saying. Like, Cloak and Dagger is the other thing that got me into role-playing games, because the intro scene of that is, you know, live action, and then it pulls away, and it turns out they're playing this, like, cool cloak, you know, spy versus spy role-playing game.
Uh-huh.
So
and I think the important part of, like, having the kids go out there is I always felt like they could do something.
Yeah.
Like, I they're kids, and but maybe they'll find a clue. Maybe they'll maybe they'll figure it out just from pursuing it more vigorously than the adults.
Yeah. And the fact that there's also consequences and danger. Like, this feels like a time of a universe that might kill one of the boys.
Will.
The
one who disappeared.
Might kill Will, or might kill Mike, or Michael Dustin, might kill any of them. 11 might die.
Yeah.
Like, the kids are, they're smart, but they're age-appropriate smart. It's not like they're smarter than the adults. They just have different priorities.
Mm-hmm.
It's the thing is, like, we're doing this podcast from the perspective of being respectful for people that are just going through this for the first time. We're trying to do a refresher for people that want to catch up before the new season, and also if, you know, have a companion for you, someone that kind of captures that first time through feeling.
Yeah. Man, I have a lot of comments on these characters first time through.
Okay.
I guess second time through from a first timer's perspective, this cop, Hopper, is really gross. Like, I don't even know what the point of brushing your teeth is if you're going to then take a big drag off your cigarette and wash down pills with old beer. Like, why? Why that order?
It removes plaque.
Brush your teeth afterward.
Yeah, true.
But he's the least offensive. There's this science teacher who looks like the perviest man alive. It's his mustache, it's his hair, it's his smile, it's everything.
That's why it was so hard as a kid in the '80s, because like all science teachers looked like pedophiles.
I guess that's
just like the '80s. Everyone looked like kind of vaguely failed perverts. So like as a kid, you just didn't, you know, you just didn't know who to keep an eye on. Yeah, he was a little.
He was a little.
I don't know. Yeah, he's fine.
Over-eager to help these boys out. I don't know. Not really. He seemed just like a helpful.
I mean, that's the thing that we talked about, like, this like on we did his Back to the Future podcast a while back, and it's like that thing where it's like there's really nothing wrong to have an older non-family mentor in your life. In fact, it's a great thing.
Sure. Yeah.
Yet because of just a vanishingly few things that have happened in the history of mankind, that's seen with suspicion. Like, right. In real life, Doc Brown would be persecuted as a potential pedophile, and Marty's family would never let him just go over there and spend hours and hours and hours in this kooky, dark, weird, experimental house dungeon thing.
They'd be like, well, why doesn't Doc come over here?
Where we
can keep an eye on him.
Yeah. And he's just always ranting and raving about plutonium and terrorist and density. So you're never going over there again, Morty. But that's... we're perpetuating. This guy's taking a genuine interest in these outcasts, and we're fucking with him.
I'll try not to. He's a great guy.
He's the guy that gets hassled because he's at a park without kids. Like, you know, get out of here, pervert. And that's the other thing.
I mean,
he's
in school. He has no option but to interact with these kids.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Like, that's the other thing. Is like everyone it's striking is these kids are just driving around at night. You know, they got headlights in their bikes.
And their
parents aren't like, you know, super up their asses about it. And like that would never happen again today.
Yeah.
Nothing has happened in the ensuing 30 years except for crime has continued to fall.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly violent crime, and yet everyone is super, like, every single time something happens, it, no matter where it is in the nation or even world, it's front page news and rammed down her throat. So parents are ultra, ultra afraid and cautious.
Yeah, I wonder if people who are, you know, maybe if you're like 20 and you grew up a decade ago, you were the age of these kids a decade ago.
Yeah.
And you weren't allowed to go do things like this, like ride your bike
at night.
Most
kids probably are. Not even in the country anymore.
That's the thing. I wonder if they look at this and say, that's so fucking stupid. That would never happen.
Yeah.
I'm here to tell you it did happen.
Yeah, right.
I rode my bike around the neighborhood all the time.
Yeah.
Sun down, sunset, sunrise. It doesn't matter where the sun is. I'm riding my bike.
Yeah. As long as I checked in before I went to bed, everything was pretty much cool.
It's the 80s for you, man.
It's the 80s. It's the 80s. We were in more danger, but blissfully unaware of it.
Yeah.
I also, the other thing about watching this, the Sheriff Hopper guy, I forget his name, the actor, but I've since learned that since the last season that he's been tapped to play Hellboy. And I've seen a couple of makeup, some test footage and stuff, and he looks amazing. And what was interesting is when he put on, like, you know, because he's kind of like this helpless, you know, shiftless, dirtbag, small-town sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
But he kind of flips into serious investigator mode. And how he's interacting with his men, that kind of detached way of, like, lost in his thoughts. And, like, it reminded me a lot of Ron Perlman's performance as Hellboy in the first two Hellboys. So, like, I at first when I heard, like, Sheriff Hopper is going to be Hellboy, that doesn't make any fucking sense. But I've since seen him. He looks legit. Mm-hmm. I can already see the performance right here as, you know, he'll be obviously a more, I don't know, he's investigating a Demogorgon, the Prince of Darkness. Like, maybe it's just going to be a Stranger Things prequel or something.
Uh-huh.
Hellboy got a skin bleached and got a dehornment procedure. And a right-handed doomectomy, or is it the left-handed doom? He's hiding out in Hawkins, Indiana. But I'm excited for Hellboy vicariously through Hopper's performance here in the Stranger Things. And also, they also set up this Winona Ryder as Joyce. Like, they're setting her where she seems like she's pretty fucking crazy.
Yeah.
And it's the perfect example of a person who just you wouldn't believe. Like, she's got a very tenuous grasp on reality, and she's got all these damaged relationships. And I thought it was interesting also when she finally, like, she didn't think the police were taking her serious. And then when the police came out and started taking her seriously, she's like, you know, the sheriff's like, wonder what the dog's freaking out about. Oh, he's probably just hungry.
Yeah.
Come on, lady. Do you want an investigation or not? You know?
Uh-huh.
But I like that, and I feel like Winona Ryder did a really great job of establishing this kind of fragility, but also like a fierce mama bear type character as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I can't say enough good about the acting in this. Everybody feels like they're there to play the character that they signed up for, not to showcase themselves or anything. Yeah. They're just there to be the character. And that goes all the way back to Elle, who we haven't talked about yet, which is a little girl who escapes from whatever facility she's at, where the Demogorgon struck. I'm going to say she gets better because she actually starts speaking, not more than no at some point this series. But, even in this episode, I think she's good. It's such a reserved performance, but it needs to be.
Yeah. She's playing what she needs to play.
Right. And she's like the key to me thinking that the kids have a chance at doing better than the adults here, right? Because there's some mysterious powers that she seems to have. Whether
there's
she's
a little
like
bit, she's an X-Man.
Yeah,
we don't know fully her powers, but we see her stop a fan with the power of her mind. And we see her slay two armed adult agents, some telekinetically or somehow.
Right.
So you're right. There is that's what you know when they hook up at the end. You're like, okay, this could be their X factor I mean, we know that she's incredibly dangerous because we also, you know, all the things I just said make her incredibly dangerous, but also she could be the edge the boys need to crack this thing wide open.
Yeah. And that's the kind of the key to all of these sort of 80s adventure movies that we loved growing up is the kids were always the linchpin of the thing, right? Like that's what makes it to me feel like those movies from the 80s. You got Elliot from E.T., you got the Flight of the Navigator, you've got the Goonies. Like those are all about the kids.
Right.
And that's what they do. They nail it so well in this series.
Right. And almost like this thing where these children understand things at this intuitive, emotional level where the adults get hung up in the logic and and obviously that's why kids are dumb and adults are smart. But in an instance where really freaky shit are happening, it's like that might be an advantage.
Right.
Because logic will just get you killed. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing to be afraid of in the dark. Bullshit. There's a whole other dimension with demonic things in it that you need to be aware of. And kids will just take that that threat seriously at face value, whereas adults will like, oh no, try to minimize it. And I think that's all those movies you mention are essentially that, like a little kid that gets a secret knowledge that adults just won't believe.
Yeah.
And that makes them the hero of the story.
Right.
That's the other thing. Like, it makes me sad when I see children's performances in like The Walking Dead or American Horror Story. And I don't know how. I don't know whether it's casting. I don't know if these kids are just naturally more talented. I suspect it's a lot about the writing. Like you have to know, you have to have a deep understanding and respect for childhood to write convincing kid dialogue, and then you have to have a director that knows how to get the performances out of. All of them are essentially amateur.
Uh-huh.
Like none of these kids have, they didn't go to fucking Juilliard. They're not classically trained method actors.
Right.
You have to work hard to get the performances out of them, and so few people don't.
Mm-hmm.
They just cast a chubby cheeked blonde kid and want him to put a pouty face on and just rely on people's concern for kids. This show really sweats those performances and it shows.
Yeah, and they shove adult dialogue into their mouths and say, hey, it's coming out of a kid, so it's a kid.
Right.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Right.
But I think they're really leaning into this idea of the kids being the thing here, especially like that creativity and that imagination, because you look at Joyce and we see a flashback, which I think was super essential because Will is barely a character in this first episode.
Uh-huh.
He has, you know, his moment with Dungeons and Dragons and the Demogorgon, and then he has this flashback with his mother in the tent or the castle buyers, which I really like because it does a lot to service Will's character. But it also, I think, sets up this idea that she is sort of willing to play along with his, you know, kid notions of everything and his imagination. And they also, I think, speak to that when they talk about Nancy and how she used to be part of the pack a little bit, right? Like 4 years ago, she dressed up as an elf or whatever in one of their campaigns. And I think since losing that, that potentially puts her at danger in my mind.
Right.
Because I think in order to effectively combat what they're witnessing here, they need to have more imagination and creativity and belief, honestly.
Yeah.
And Nancy might not have that.
I also want to talk about the soundtrack.
Uh-huh.
Because like they have some really clever choices. They get the stuff that's composed for the show, like the theme, the like really kind of ominous synth track that plays behind a really cool Stephen King-esque blood red Stranger Thing title. But like when, you know, Benny, I think it's when Benny first finds Eleven, they're playing White Rabbit from Jefferson Airplane, which is essentially about someone having this uncanny experience. It's ostensibly about Alice in Wonderland, but I think it also is a stand-in for fucking with drugs.
As was everything in the 70s but then, and 60s.
What's Nancy's kind of douchey, preppy, big hair boyfriend?
Steve.
Like when Steve is attempting to seduce her in her bedroom, the Toto's Africa is playing, which is like the standard bearer for this kind of earnest but cringy, like, oh man, I wish we could do something about the, like, it's utterly sincere to the point that it's insincere.
Yeah.
And like emotionally I felt that was perfect for that scene, because there's this is just a bullshit artist trying to get in this woman's pants. And like I reserved the right to change my mind later on, because I honestly don't remember a lot about how this plot goes, but I don't see Steve as a bad guy. He's certainly upfront about what he's trying to do, and Nancy's finding him charming, and he is respecting her limits. Like when she says no,
right.
He backs off and starts studying again.
Back to the cue
cards. She wasn't completely unreceptive nor turned off by his advances. Like she found that. So it's like I try to separate my, like, I think just like base jealousy of a guy who's just like really good with women from like just like, oh, is he douchey because he's got a punchable face?
Because he looks like Andrew Garfield.
Because he looks like
Andrew Garfield. Wait,
is
that his name? James Garfield? James, I can't remember his name.
Garfield.
No, the guy who played Spider-Man.
Yeah, yeah. No,
like,
I know
not the most
about.
Recently, but before that.
I know who you're talking about. Do I not like him because he's smarmy, or do I not like him because he's a fucking womanizing cat, or is he a potential proto-rapist? I don't know. But
and
right now,
the lines are always so fuzzy in these situations, right?
Right now, that I find it very, very little actionable information to hate on him. Like if he showed up to date my daughter, I would be on high alert, but I couldn't actually put the hammer down on him, you know?
Right. Point to that thing and say, "There, that's
yes,
the douchey
look
thing
at his
you
hair.
Do.
Look at his hair." It just screams Eddie Haskell. I like that music choice and how what it says about the things going on in the show. And you know, also just the ambient kind of emotional original soundtrack.
Yeah, the synths are strong in this
show.
So
good and
love
so
them.
Flavorful for the 80s.
Right. Yeah.
Do you want to talk about the other thing is like that's that I find really good is they did a lot of like this reminds me of like any other Golden Age show where like you go down the cast and you can't find any weaknesses. Like they cast this Chris Sullivan, who had only seen before as the ambulance driver from The Nick, who is just like, you know, he exudes this like gruff but heart of gold persona.
Yeah.
And he brings all that to the table, like this ferocity, you know, like he's like, you would want to piss him off, but right now he's not pissed off and he's trying to comfort a scared little girl, and you just buy it. Like he doesn't come across as a creep.
No, he's the opposite of the science teacher.
Yeah, and he like positions him as like, oh, he can be like this guardian. And I remember watching the series like, oh man, it's going to be cool. But then he just gets blown away, which is, you know, makes you feel something for Eleven, and also underlines the danger that she's in. And then she ends up killing all those people, which underlines the danger that she is. But like all these, like Matthew Modine, all these people are as the head scumbag research scientist. All these people are batting well above average. And like the fact that you'd take Chris Sullivan and throw him into like a 5-minute role, I thought was super impressive.
Yeah, there's nobody here who's doing a subpar job.
No.
Everybody is bringing it.
No. To the extent that I guess that's if we want to look forward to season 2, because there is a season 2 and it's coming out, That's the one thing I'm afraid of, because I saw an interview with I heard an interview on Dan Harmon's Harmontown podcast with the Duffer Brothers. And he's like, essentially, you know, Dan's got this rambling way of interviewing, and he's stumbling around his question about, like, aren't you guys scared to death that you've got to now turn around to season two? And they're like,
well,
they're
we
like,
weren't until you mentioned
no,
it.
No, and they're like, totally. Like, all our adult lives, we've been working on this script and this concept, and, like, it was like a self-contained thing to say, and we have no idea what happens next, and now we have to turn around another one in like less than 12 months, and we are scared to death of how we're not going to crap the bed. So,
I mean, the preview makes it look awesome.
I know, and like, that's the thing. Like, maybe these guys are just natural geniuses, or maybe they're smart. Like you know, part of being a genius is also surrounding yourself with other people that are geniuses. So, like, they get help in the writing room, and you know, they already got this network of talented directors that they can lean on, and plus, this show did well for itself.
Yeah.
So I imagine you could call any director that, hey, do you want to do this acclaimed, popular Steven Spielberg, Stephen King-esque thing that has excellent cast of young actors and distinguished, like, you know, Winona Ryder. Like, who is going to be like, no, fuck you.
Yeah.
So they can call on a pretty deep cast. So that's the things they got going for it. The things they got going against is, how do you match the passion and attention to detail of 5+ years working on this professionally with 6 months of locking yourself in desperation?
Right. I don't know. We'll see if they can do it. I'm excited for it, and I think, you know, if you're writing what you know, all you really need to come up with is the plot of like the basic plot of season two, right?
Yeah.
And you can kind of lean on your just intuitive understanding of the setting and the time and these characters.
You're right, because the characters,
in order to advance that plot.
And I remember that's one of the things they talked in about the interview, is like, they weren't even sure if they were going to continue the Demogorgon 11. Like, this might just be like Stranger Things is an anthology about,
oh man,
like small town life. But it's like, that's kind of exciting too. Like, if they just completely have another like maybe this program is also happening in Seattle, like, or like the backwoods of Washington State, or. But
I just think it's less rewarding for an audience.
Oh yeah,
like, I've invested time in these characters. Yeah. I want to get more of those characters.
Yeah, no, for sure. And you know, obviously that's the direction they took.
Yeah,
but that's a good point, because it's much easier if you've taken the time to develop these rich characters. You're right. All you need is an inciting thing,
yeah,
an inciting incident, and then you just let the characters play. You add a few new ones to replace some of the ones you lost along the way.
Hope they don't roll a 7.
Hope they don't roll a 7. Or maybe they cast protection.
Yeah.
What else do you want to talk about?
I think that's about it. There's just a real good vibe to this show. And it's one that I immediately liked when I started watching it. And it carries through the rest of the series. So if you enjoyed this first episode and you haven't seen the rest of it, definitely strap in, because it's just as good, and it gets more intense and better.
Now I want to talk. Can we have a little meta discussion about the podcast?
Okay.
Jim and I are going to try to cover season two in a binge mode format. Like,
yeah,
we're going to take a weekend and just knock it out. So you might have noticed, if you're Bald Move fans, that this is not our full podcast treatment, because we're leery of doing like a full on recap with heavy analysis. And getting people expecting that, and then going to season two, and everything is a lot more shotgun and ill prepared, and because we're just going to be marathon, similar to what we did the first two seasons of House of Cards.
And Dan Harmon would ask us, so do you have any fears about disappointing your fans in season two?
Oh yeah, it's inevitable. We're not going to have infinite time to think about this stuff,
right,
and research and do the definitive podcast. And also, we're thinking, like, what is the audience like? What is the audience for season one of a podcast for a show that came out a year ago? It's probably for people that are returning and want to, like, refresh their memory or have some light discussion for the first time viewers if they're just now getting around to watching season one.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to do feedback, but it's going to be in a different format. For example, we're going to drop all of these podcasts for season one in very quick succession. We're not recording any feedback for that, but we're going to have a preview podcast where we will encourage you to send in feedback to strangerthings@baldmove.com, because it's surprisingly hard to spell Demogorgon.
Yeah.
You could spell like six wrong. Different ways. And so Stranger Things, it's right there on your screen. You can pause it on Netflix, take out the space, add an at-bald move. We're going to consider all your thoughts and predictions and fears for the preview podcast. And then we'll also be doing a wrap-up podcast for season two. Same deal, where after, you know, a week has gone by or two, we will do a roundup of like everybody's thoughts and feelings and favorite moments of that season. So it'll be less of, because of the format, unfortunately, we can't take feedback in the 30 minutes in between episodes that we allow ourselves to get our notes together. But it is a big part of most of our shows, and that's how we're going forward. So I just want to, for people that might be concerned, like, oh, this isn't the same Bald Move podcast, it's the format. Like, we've tried many different ways to do a Netflix show, and it seems like the best one is this. It's because then, like, there's an episode, there's a discussion for every episode, and you can watch it at your own pace, and wherever you stop off, there'll be a podcast there waiting for you. Yeah. And it's going to be a rough weekend, but I'm excited. I'm excited for season two. So yeah, the rest, got seven more episodes to cover in this kind of like half instant take podcast format, and then we'll be back with the preview, and then we'll be set up for season two. Thanks for listening to our season one coverage of Stranger Things. If you like what you hear and want more, check out all of our television, movie, and pop culture content on baldmove.com. If you'd like to help support our podcast and get a ton of bonus content and features, check out club.baldmove.com. We'll also be taking feedback during our upcoming Season 1 wrap-up podcast, so send that in to strangerthings@baldmove.com. You can also discuss this with your fellow fans at forums.baldmove.com or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Until next time, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.